Get off my world.
Get off my world.
Get off my world.
Call is now being recorded.
Hi, I'm Joshua.
I'm Pat.
And I'm Kelvin.
And this is Get Off My World. We're three guys who love the classic Doctor Who series and try our best to love the new series, too. We'll take you through five rounds rapid and get to the bottom of what's great and not so great about our favorite show. And today's mini-sode is about the Zygon Inversion, written by Peter Harness and Stephen Moffat. And it is the second part of the Zygon Invasion. And we're going to start this mini-sode like we start all of our mini-sodes with round one, temporal grace. We like to share one thing that we really liked about the episode. Calvin?
I'm going to say Jenna Coleman's performance. I think this is the best acting Jenna Coleman's ever done on the series. She brought really clear differences to Clara and the Zygella, I guess is what the doctor was calling her. It actually made me wonder if she was like miscast as a nice girl and she should have always been playing villains or something.
I'm with you. I thought she was terrific, man. She did a lot with stillness, very subtle body language when she's standing there over the box. So I'm going to go big picture and say that I, just broadly speaking, very much like this new assimilationist thing that they're doing with the Zygons. I think it's maybe done a little clumsily. I had some harsh words for it in the last episode, and I don't think it was done entirely all that well in this one, too, but I just like the idea that they can do that with the Zygons. I think maybe I was selling it a little bit short last week. I think there is more rich thematic material there with secret Zygon integration into human society. This is not something they could have done with any of the other classic villains, right? The Ice Warriors are not going to be, you know, going out shopping at Costco and whatever and pretending to be human.
Can you imagine how long the lines would be at Costco if you were behind an Ice Warrior?
Where is the frozen food?
It would just take forever.
You can do it with the Zygons because, I mean, well, for one thing, they have the shape-changing ability, but beyond that, they're not over, what's the literary critical term, over-determined. They're not over-determined, right? Like, we know what the Daleks are through many, 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 many years of Dalek stories, but in the classic series, we only had one Zygon story, and so they can refer back to that in the new series, but there isn't a lot of backstory to work with. They can do new, interesting stuff like this, and I think this idea of a whole Zygon society integrating itself or attempting to into human society is terrific, and it is thematically very rich. It just must be wonderful for the writers on the series, right? Because at any point in the future, if the doctor's on Earth and he's in a jam, they could just have someone in the background turn into a Zygon friend of his and save him, right? Just on a pure plotting level, it's just there's so many get-out-of-jail-free cards that you can do with that. So, yeah, I was a little bit kind of down on it last week, but I've really come over to the other side. I dig the whole concept of it very deeply.
Well, I'm going to go with something a lot more shallow. I hate to be the nerd who just rolls over and pees on himself every time there's a fan servicey old series reference. But when the doctor referred to Harry Sullivan as an imbecile, I peed on myself. It did my heart so much good. Particularly because as a child, that stands out. It was maybe the Revenge of the Cybermen was maybe the fifth or sixth Doctor Who story I had seen. And it was one of those standout moments that I remember going, this show isn't like anything else. The main guy just stood in a cavern and screamed that someone was an imbecile. And that stuck with me since I was 12 years old. I loved it.
When you started your statement, I thought for sure you were going to pick Kate Stewart saying five rounds rapid.
Yeah, more fan service.
Yep, yeah. And you know, that was satisfying, but it didn't make me pee on myself.
than normal.
Well, yeah. Round two, Doctor in Distress. This is the round that we take a little look at Peter Capaldi and the 12th Doctor and how he is developing in this series. And I kind of went out of my way not to read a lot of reviews online, but it definitely seems to be just by looking at headlines, everyone is kind of falling over themselves over the big speech at the end, anti-war message, and calling it his defining moment as the Doctor. So it seems like that might be a good place to start.
Well, I'm not going to go too far against the conventional wisdom there. That last 10 or 15 minutes really made the episode for me. I'll qualify a little bit by saying that this is the sort of thing that I think Peter Capaldi can probably do in his sleep at this point after several seasons of the thick of it. He's just slightly less wary, but he can yell and rant with the best of them that I know. And I think that although the speech is really great, it probably could have used another pass or two to make it a little bit more concrete and less abstract and not reliant on, well, you know, cheesy American accents and clumsy appeals to experience in the Doctor's own experience of the Time War. But that's all. I want to kind of push all of those objections to the side and say that I think that it was really terrific. It was both terrific on a performance level. And I do like that Doctor Who does at least seriously attempt to articulate an alternative mode of ethics some of the time, right? Even if it's kind of clumsy and juvenile, as it frequently is. Yeah, it's a very earnest way of trying to address real-world problems in a fictional environment, and if it maybe opens up more questions than it actually answers, it at least starts maybe the viewers thinking in this direction. Does that make sense, you know? I mean, he's really articulating a very strong anti-violence position, even if it's sophomoric in some of its content, and he sells it with the force of his personality, and I thought that part of things was terrific.
Well, Pat sort of took all my words and said them. I pretty much agree with that. It's okay. I forgive you, because that's what it's all about. Forgiveness. I guess I would echo the editing. That's all I wish. I wish there'd just been a tiny bit of editing on it. That's the first thing I thought, is like it was just so close to perfect. But again, I look at this as a family show, and the fact that you're trying to write to all ages, and the fact that Peter Capaldi managed to string it all together, and just watching his face, if you just turned on the volume and watched the various transformations on Peter Capaldi's face alone, it's pretty phenomenal. Yeah, if I separate those two things, the writing and the performance, and then the performance kind of informs some forgiveness to the writing, it's still a great scene.
Yeah, I don't know what to add. I agree with all the internet chatter about it. I didn't have any problems with the speech being long or anything. I thought it was great. It kind of covered all the Doctor bases of being sort of humorous and yet really impassioned and, you know, clearly coming from, the Doctor's personal experience and stuff. He's not just making a philosophical point. It's personal. And I can't remember the name, but when he's kind of doing this sort of American-y accent, it's a reference to some BBC presenter person. I don't know if he's like a game show host or something. He's like so show busy, he actually kind of does an American accent when he's doing his stuff. So like that's actually like a reference to some very peculiar to Great Britain celebrity that no American would ever have heard of. But
it's a pop culture thing that we'll never get. Yeah, so for the record, I didn't find it too. I certainly didn't find the scene too long. In fact, I probably could have dealt with the entire episode just the Peter Capaldi going off like that, and I think I would have liked the entire thing better. It was only some of the quality of the dialogue, but I think Josh has successfully defended that. But no, I would never. Don't take a minute of Peter Capaldi raving away from me. I'll take as much of that as you're willing to serve up.
Well, and I will say that I think I've seen some comments online, just some minimal comments about that you'll find that the Doctor's acting like the Doctor, and this is the defining moment. And I mean, I certainly understand that, as in it's sort of the 12th Doctor almost laid out his kind of motivation as a character there, but I feel like it's kind of dismisses a lot of other stuff earlier on that I think Capaldi has done pretty fantastically. And I also think if we hadn't had something like Series 8, this would not have felt as cathartic. And I don't feel like this was suddenly Capaldi's acting like the Doctor now. I just think it's sort of a culmination of things. And I don't think we've seen that as much with some of the other new series Doctors.
Yeah, it's the gear of Peter Capaldi and the gear of the stories finally meshing for a short period, it seems. Like, one or the other they're never quite on the same track, right? We've often said on this podcast that he's kind of a little bit working against the material that he's given, and we've certainly had highly critical things to say about a lot of the writing for the last season and a half. But here, it seemed like, yeah, somebody had the idea to just let him show off and work to his strengths for the first time since the first episode of season 8. And yeah, I thought it worked tremendously. I hope we see more of it.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like he had a lot of great performances with a lot of scripts that clicked before this, but this is such a just all Capaldi. He is the force behind that scene, and it's a long scene where I think he was fantastic in Luke, and that was a great script. I thought he did an amazing and subtle job with stuff in the Mummy on the Orient Express, and he was quite interesting in his opening episode too, but we don't need to nitpick. I don't need to nitpick.
What? We need to nitpick.
If we don't nitpick, there's no reason for us to even be here.
Our fans expect it from us.
You know, it's like beyond existentialism. It's our reason for drawing breath.
Round 3, friends and foes. We'll take a little look at the enemies and the friends in this episode. And there are a lot of them every time we land on Earth with UNIT and 20 million Zygons. There's a lot to talk about.
Jack is dead, apparently, right? So she was actually killed last episode. I thought maybe that she would come back, but no. Yeah, the hell with the middle-aged black lady, right? Okay.
No more of those.
I was disappointed. So I want to say something about this that's going to tie into our round 4 discussion, the big picture thing, because there's a deep thematic thing that Capaldi talks about in his speech about how you need to break the cycle of violence and you need to forgive and you need to go forward, which is positive liberal attitude that I think most of us would probably agree with in the abstract. But it's partly reliant on this idea of selective forgetting of all of the things that have gone in the past, right? I mean, in this case specifically, a lot of people got killed. Lots and lots and lots of people got killed, especially last episode. Almost all of them soldiers, but also those people in New Mexico. And Jack, you know, was just murdered by Bonnie, you know, a few hours ago in the time frame of the story. And so I'm not saying that the fundamental ethical point is wrong, because you have to kind of do this selective forgetting if you're going to move away from the cycle of violence. But the show itself seems to kind of forget about these things, too, to make its point, right? All of these people got killed, but most of them got killed last episode. We didn't really see a lot of death in this one, except that poor guy who wound up being outed as Zygon, and he killed himself.
Yeah.
And it even erases the pilots of the plane, right? Were there pilots on that plane that got blown up when the Doctor and Osgood were on there? We see them bailing out. There's no indication that the pilots did, and no references ever made to them, too, right? So the story itself is trying to erase these people in order to make its ethical point at the end.
I'm just trying to wonder, like, the last time the present the world plane showed up, it wasn't established that it had pilots? Or was it some kind of, like, future robot-piloted plane or something?
There were some complaints because they showed a plane being blown up so close to the Russian plane, and the BBC stated in an official statement that everyone survived their exploding plane, unlike the Russian one. That wasn't anyone involved in the show who said that, but the BBC claims everyone survived.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I'm willing to go with that. You know, like, I was kind of hoping, oh, it's a robot plane, too, like Elvin is saying. And I don't remember from Death in Heaven when it was established whether people were piloting it or not. But I think my wider world stands. But maybe this is a topic that's better suited for round four. So let's put a pin in it, and let's talk about people like Osgood, right? Because there's lots to say about her, or hers. Them.
I like them. Mm.
So first of all, she has this whole line about, oh, you're the doctor, you're talking nonsense to prevent me from being really scared, right? But Osgood, at no time then or at any other time that we have ever seen her, has seemed to be the least bit scared. And this seems kind of like a representative discontinuity with the show as a whole, right? It's like, oh, there's supposed to be all these scary things happening, but no one ever acts as if there's any sort of threat whatsoever, and they're always like, oh, it's a big adventure. So it's kind of like different parts of new Doctor Who rubbing up against one another. I'm not sure if the actor playing Osgood really knew what she was supposed to be doing there.
Or you could read that she's so familiar with the Doctor that she can list off his tactics that she's not afraid because she knows has control of the situation. That's how it seems like the actress chooses to play it. It seems like when she's with the Doctor, she understands and has studied so much that she has complete and utter confidence in him.
Yeah, that's a good interpretation. Yeah, she's just serenely unconcerned about everything happening. Because she knows
plus, it happened 15 times before, apparently, but that's probably another thing to put a pin in until.
Yeah, we'll have to talk about that.
Yeah.
Well, I'm assuming that even Sans Doctor that Osgood has had some kind of fairly crazy encounters through working with the unit anyway, so she may be more unflappable than average.
We'll find out as soon as I listen to that big Finnish unit audio that just came out. Connected to that, I am curious to see in this unit audio, it connects to this episode, but I feel that Kate Stewart doesn't have much of a personality yet in any of these TV episodes, and that's one of the reasons I'm excited about the unit audio is to see if she actually has a distinct personality. She seems to be there purely for nostalgia and to fulfill the role that the writers think the audience vaguely remembers about the Brigadier. And while it is still satisfying because she's a great actress, she has a great screen presence, it's great to hear her say five rounds rapid and shoot the hell out of a Zygon. I'd love to see a character episode in Series 10 or something where the Doctor ends up just with her. She is a surrogate companion for an episode, and not a bunch of backstory, but we actually get to see her personality. How is she informed by the Brigadier, but how is she different? I mean, I think we see it a little bit when she walks away from the box at the end, that maybe that's not something her dad would have done, or maybe it is, but I don't know. I like the character. I would like to see a little more insight into her. Without being super emo. Speaking of friends, we should talk about Clara. And one of the bits in this episode that I really liked, even though it's kind of well-tread territory under Moffat, is I really liked Clara's struggle to gain control of her Zygon doppelganger as it was shooting the missile at the plane. Often cliffhangers just resolve themselves really in a quick, tidy sort of way, and I like this prolonged solution to the cliffhanger, and I thought it actually played out really nice and was fairly tense for Doctor Who.
Your performance was great. I admired what must have been Stephen Moffat writing all of the weirdness with the information processing problems, the garbaged out newspapers and the toothpaste that said this is a tube of toothpaste or whatever. It seemed like very Moffat-y ideas that were again just sort of thrown in there, but they really helped make the texture of that scene, I thought.
It had a lot of, like, dream logic stuff, like when she's looking through the tabloid and it's all gibberish.
It's interesting that this is the first episode where I felt like they really gave her a lot to do this series. So it was a nice reminder, because she's leaving really soon, that, oh, she has things to add to this show. Oh. I'm still probably not going to miss her because I still think there's something fundamentally lacking between her and Capaldi. It's weird when there are two phenomenal actors, yet I don't want to be so strong as to say there's no chemistry, but yet it just doesn't. There's something about whether it's their characterizations, it just doesn't, and Capaldi tries to sell it too about how much he feels for her, and it just, it all rings a little hollow, and I'm not sure whose doorstep that goes to.
100% with you on this. I love both of them, and I don't get anything out of the two of them together. So when they're separated, I think they're terrific. Well, should we close out this segment by talking about Osgood a little bit? So first, you guys, there's potentially two Zygon Osgoods at the end there, right? Isn't that against the spirit of the agreement? Because the first one was just churlish about not saying whether she was a Zygon or not. But we know that the former Bonnie was a Zygon.
The Zygon's new powers are very unclear. My initial thought was that she must be the human Zygon because that's why Bonnie can transform. But we don't know if Zygons mimic other Zygons mimicking other people. It's just like Russian dolls. It's craziness.
You know, it's also another example of this, of the new Who's kind of cavalier attitude toward being able to replace people. We talked about this on the podcast more than once, right, where, Rose's mom can go into the alternate universe and find another version of Rose's dad, and that somehow that equates to the same person. Like, people, if they are copied to a sufficient degree, can actually replace the people that you've lost. So here, we spent a lot of time last episode with Osgood mourning the death of her sister, human or Zygon, whatever it was. But here, I guess it's okay if we just have a new Zygon take the role of that sister. Like, what does that mean existentially, right?
Yeah.
What does it mean in terms of who human beings are? Or what they, is it simply the roles they play? Is that really what it comes down to in Doctor Who? If you're sufficiently identical to another human being, you're functionally the same and emotionally can, you know, fill the same role. I find that very disturbing.
There isn't any obvious differentiation between Zygons. Not to be racist or anything, but, you know, Zygons all look alike.
Round 4, the big picture. Did this episode work? That's what we're asking.
So, you guys, you know as well as I do that the term inversion is an old-timey psychological word for homosexuality, right? Well, I am super disappointed that given the show's generally good track record with GLBTQ issues, I was disappointed to not see a single Zygon invert in the entire thing. I think that's a real missed opportunity.
Are you sure the guy who was forced to reveal himself was not that and then ended up committing suicide because he was bullied by the other Zygons?
Well, if that's true, that would be a disappointingly old-fashioned sort of gay story. You know, I've seen that one a million times. But you're right, they might be playing with that. He might have been a Zygon invert.
Well,
along those lines, the Doctor's pretty obtuse about transgender Zygon issues, isn't he? I mean, he talks to Osgood like 3 or 4 times over the course of these 2 episodes about, who are you? Who are you? Are you a human or a Zygon? And they even, like, say, gotcha, and he's being kind of stupid about it at the end, right? As if somehow a young human being and a former Zygon terrorist know more about identity rights than a Time Lord who's lived for 2,000 years and has inhabited 13 bodies. I don't get that part.
To me, it's clear the Doctor wants to solve this problem. It's like he wants to know. He always wants to know the answer. It's not a, he doesn't want to give it any sort of weight, what the answer is, whether it has any sort of moral weight or anything. He feels like the little kid who has to know, which one are you? And he's also, on a metatextual level, he's being the voice of the audience, right? Because the audience really want to know who's who.
Maybe that's what I'm reacting to, because the Doctor should never be the voice of the audience. It's the companion's job or the secondary character's job to be the voice of the audience. Maybe Clara, as a savvy 21st century woman, it would just read weird for her to be asking those questions, and maybe it somehow sounds better coming out of Peter Capaldi's mouth. But
I think it's partly because, you know, an aspect of the 12th Doctor that's been established is that he's one of the more obtuse doctors about people in general.
But he also really has to figure things out, though, and I think we're kind of,
yeah.
Well, maybe we are, as well as maybe the writers are mixing this many levels on a narrative level, on what they're doing thematically with this. It doesn't matter whether I'm Zygon a human or character-based with the doctor, he has to know and he has to be right. I think the idea that the doctor can't figure it out, it's well within his character to be annoyed by that he can't figure out whether she was the human or the Zygon. I can see the doctor lecturing somebody else about it doesn't matter whatsoever as long as I know which one it is. You know, that's how I took it.
And I'm willing to psychologize it in that way. Even though, yeah, fundamentally you're right, it's only as a way to raise the theme in an explicit way and to deny that the question has validity. What else, like big picture stuff? I think we put a pin in this a little bit earlier. Maybe it's my
pin.
I think it was my
pin. Take that pin out.
Right. I do kind of like this story this sort of type of story in general, where the idea of people who were violent political opponents, terrorists or enemy agents or other nations or whatever, are forced to participate in power-sharing politics or government. There's plenty of real-world examples like this, like in Ireland with the Sinn Féin Party or in South Africa after apartheid fell. But, you know, throughout the history of the world, there's plenty of occasions where former political opponents, sometimes extremely violent and vicious ones, are now ruling together. And so I love stories that point in this direction with the Zygon stuff at the end, integrating into human society in a new way. Battlestar Galactica did this for a little while. If you guys remember, there was the former terrorist who was played by was he Starbuck in the original series? My memory is vague. I remember he used to be a terrorist. He was in jail, and then he was part of the power-sharing government on a ship after a while, and I thought that was a really interesting direction for them to go. And then, of course, like Battlestar Galactica always did, they took this sort of garbage way out, and they turned it into a military coup, and they executed the guy. Sorry, spoilers. Anyway, I like the idea that they do that, but I'm not sure that television can do it in any meaningful way. I thought Battlestar Galactica failed at that, and here I think it sort of gestures in that direction, but does it in a kind of Doctor Who-ish, childish way that's resolved through Peter Capaldi's great speech, but it's still reminiscent of all those speeches that people like Ben Grimm gave in the old Fantastic Four comics when he would talk down a mob of angry racists and say, like, no, you really shouldn't be racist. We should really all love one another, right? It's still that sort of narrative motion that brings the narrative resolution happening, right? I just don't think that TV can really necessarily do the kind of depth of real political understanding that novels accomplish. And now I'm just rambling,
well,
you guys.
No. I get that, and people always use that as an argument for, like, you know, television movies have to dumb everything down, and it's like, it can't do that sort of detailed analysis by its very nature, and that doesn't mean it's dumber or something. It just,
some shows can, but not every show can. I mean, Doctor Who isn't Breaking Bad or The Wire, which are some of the shows that come the closest to feeling like a televised novel in the way they unpack themes,
right,
and character studies. But the weird thing with Doctor Who, and I'm constantly trying to figure out if I'm going to judge it for it or I'm going to forgive it for it, is that it's hugely limited in that it's a goofy science fiction show for all ages, but it keeps wanting to tackle these sort of bigger issues, but then by default it has to simplify them, and it doesn't really play out within the narrative limitations of the show. And do you either judge a show because it's decided to tackle these, so you have to judge it because you've decided to tackle this and you couldn't come through on it, or do you kind of forgive it or applaud it for going right up to the very limits of what this show could possibly do? And this episode seemed to be a real example of that, where I kept going back and forth whether I wanted to judge it harshly because of its failures or because of what it tried to do. So I still don't know which way to judge it.
Yeah, it's unresolvable to me. And last week we talked a little bit about, and I was pretty harsh on the first part. I still am, because I thought it was just playing with real-world ideas, you know, concepts of terrorism, concepts of assimilation, just to give the show a kind of false texture. Here in the second part, they clearly had a point. that was more meaningful than the sort of playing around that they had in the first part. But I don't, and I do like that better because, you know, I do sort of like my art to have a point and not just play around with the material of the world like your Law and Orders or CSIs do, just the kind of garbage of the present day. But yeah, when you get down to it, I don't know whether it makes much difference. Right?
Here's what really bugged me about this episode, and it's kind of tied into what we're talking about, is it's this has happened 15 times before. And connected to that is the wiping of Kate Stewart's mind, which seems to open up this whole ethical door. I found it really creepy, the idea that they keep doing this and keep wiping her mind and other people's minds after that big, very bombastic moral speech of the doctor's, well-performed and everything, but it's like, there's a lot of dubiousness, I think, in wiping someone's mind and making them go through that over and over again, like she's a child or not an autonomous human being. And
so on the one hand, you have the doctor must be clearly assured by this time, 15 times in, that Kate is going to make the right decision, right? Absolutely, no problem. Okay, and she agrees to it every time. Well, she didn't agree to it this time. He just kind of forced her mind, but he said earlier that she had agreed to the mind wipe. But on the other hand, what happened to all of the other Zygons on the other side those 15 times, right? Like, you don't just wipe Kate's mind for 15 times for no reason. There must have been some purpose to it. And were there other Zygon terrorists that... It's like a genocidal Groundhog Day. Were they all... they're not floating around up there. Bonnie didn't get her mind wiped 15 times, or there's no indication of it, right? And so what happened to those guys?
I think it would have been far more powerful if this was the first time and that he had solved it, and maybe this idea that it might happen again, so he's leaving everything in place, and this hint that maybe he'd have to do this again in the future. I think if they did it the opposite way, it might have worked. But that was one of those times where Moffat, I know a lot of people love to accuse him of being too clever, and this is one of those things where he added a little bit of a clever twist that was not only, to me, not needed, but also undermined everything that had just happened to me. And I found it really disappointing. Although it's the only way to explain why the doctor would have... Well, it doesn't even explain the truth or consequences in the box. That's the other thing it really...
Oh, man, don't get me started on the truth and consequences.
It's like,
thing. That's something that came out of a writer's mind and then got backfilled into the story, but there isn't any... Where does it come from? We thought it came from the Zygon revolutionaries, and they took it maybe from the town that they started in, although that's a pretty dumb slogan to say this is the town that we're in, right? But then the doctor clearly knows about it and has written about it or has inscribed it into the boxes that he's got. It doesn't make any sense.
Unless,
and even on a thematic level, it should be truth and consequences, right? Because that's what the ethical outcome of pushing those buttons would be, right? The truth would come out and the consequences would follow from that. It's not an either-or thing. It's thematically super blurry, and it makes no narrative sense whatsoever that I can determine.
The only way you can justify it is if the idea that it has happened 15 times before, which means maybe the doctor makes new boxes that are crisis-specific each time. So if the revolution starts somewhere else, the buttons, you know, say something about Istanbul or...
embarrass Minnesota.
And you can choose either embarrass or Minnesota, and you realize it's the same thing. That, to me, is the most unfortunate part of this. The second half, I really liked it, but those are the parts that bug me. But at the same time, there's something to be said when it is the last, like, 5 minutes of a show. It's easier to forgive than if it's the middle 10 or 15 minutes.
Is it time to rate it, you guys?
I think so, and it's very hard for me.
It's tough, so let's start with Calvin.
Because Calvin never has problems with indecision.
I never do I? But my only indecision is to pick a wacky item for the stars. I'm going to give it 4.5 Union Jack parachutes. I really liked it. The stuff you guys have been griping about for the past 10 minutes, I'm like, just didn't register on me on any level. I don't know.
That's your role.
I'm the dumb one, I know, but yeah.
No, you're the happy one.
I'm just not a horrible cynic like everyone else, I don't know.
Yeah, that's fair. When I first watched it, I really dug it a lot. And then on subsequent viewings, I'm like, well, what I really like is just that Peter Capaldi scene. And everything else is kind of, whatever. So I have to give it a higher rating than The Girl Who Died, which is, I think, the highest on my list so far. And that got a 3.5. So let's give it 3 Petronellas and 1 goddamn all-star Peter Capaldi.
This is one that I may revisit. It's just one of those ones that I think my mind may change on subsequent viewings with a little more time. But right now, the end really bugged me. I would say I'm going to give it 3.5 imbeciles. I want to give it closer to 4, but again, I think a lot of that is just the performances of Jenna Coleman and Capaldi. But that's enjoyment too. So it's on the verge there, a little higher than 3.5 imbeciles. But I think for right now, that's where it's gonna land.
All right, you guys, we've talked for a long time, so just a few seconds, I think, for our round 5, right? What we're speculating on.
The only big indicators of the end of the season is Capaldi's references to just how much Clara means to him. And I've read a couple places, and again, I don't know how accurate that is, that Jenna Coleman's leaving before the season is over. I've read a couple sources saying it's the episode 10, and that we might be without a companion for the last 2 episodes of the series. So we might be getting really, really close to the end there, and that seemed the only wild speculation I have, is that it just seems more and more like they're going to have to kill her off, yeah, because
storm clouds are gathering. They've certainly implied that through subtext.
Well, they've been hinting in the interviews and stuff, from what I've seen, that they're hinting it will be a sad ending, but I'm assuming it's going to be like Amy and Rory sad, or Don. Rose sad, and not like Adric sad.
Adric wasn't sad.
Well, I mean, sad in the sense of, well, he's dead. There's no two ways about it.
I think, again, we're dealing with a sort of almost meta problem, in that Jenna Coleman said she was going to leave. The Christmas special was clearly written in one draft where it was supposed to have her leave and have a sad, touching parting of the ways. And then she changed her mind. They brought her back. And so they added a new ending to the Christmas special. And so it just feels like we've already done it. So it seems like they almost have to one-up themselves with something very cosmic. And it is the problem, and one of my issues with the new series is that the love the Doctor has for each companion means they can never just leave. They can never go on with their life because the Doctor appears to be able to control his TARDIS and appears to be just fine to come in and out of their life. So they need to find some reason to explain why the Doctor doesn't keep visiting them. So it's this weird corner. It forces every departure to be cosmic and dramatic, and how many more companions can be caught in another universe, trapped within some rules of time where he can't go back and visit them? They're almost out of ideas. They almost have
to. Well, yeah, but
they can do.
That's the consequence of, I don't know, there's just so many times in, the old series when the companion left, it was so perfunctory. It was just, even the more heartfelt goodbyes, like with Sarah Jane Smith or Joe Grant. You know, for every one of those, there was a couple Dodos and Mel's. I mean, Mel's literally like, well, I'm not coming with you, Doctor. Okay, fine.
I'm going
off. Why even put that on the screen?
Flavor and murderer. Yeah.
A lot of times the companions were there and having a little bit of fun, but, for them to just decide to leave made sense. There's a lot of great companion departures in the old series, too, just because they didn't spend an entire season full of foreshadowing.
Yeah, I mean, welcome to the era of plot arcs. I mean, everything's got to be foreshadowed, and you can't really have anything be standalone ever.
Let me put this out there as a crude model of the two types of television drama and comedy that there can be. There can be a workplace drama, and there can be a family drama, right? Or maybe workplace comedy or family comedy, right? But in the first instance, people can come and go, like on Barney Miller or Law and Order or whatever, and nobody thinks much of it because we have that model for how people come and go in our real lives, because we work with them and then we don't work with them. But in family stories, family ties or growing pains or that 70s show or whatever, it's much, much, much harder to get people out of a show if the actor doesn't want to continue to do it. You can recast them, you can ignore their existence, or you can have something happen in the plot where they get killed or they go off to find themselves or something like that, right? And I would say that Doctor Who, the classic Doctor Who series, was much more of a workplace show, the Doctor and his workaday companions, and the new Doctor Who is much more of a family show, right? They're playing up the emotional component, and so they have to fall all over themselves to try to find interesting ways for these characters to go away permanently.
The problem is their family drama now has a time machine. So with that, at the center of the family drama, it is so hard to find a way to permanently write out a character, even more so than your standard family drama. I mean, it's and even now with Death in Heaven and the end of Series 8, even killing off somebody now has a certain amount of question marks on it. They have to bend over backwards to find a way to make a companion gone.
But now maybe we'll get the Cyber Brigadier model, right? It doesn't matter if the actor can come back, or in Nicholas Courtney's case, whether he's even actually physically the real person is dead. We just bring the guy back as a CGI Cyberman or something like that. And, oh, yeah, there we go. So that's going to be the companion model in the future. We're going to have Cyber Dodo and Cyber Zoe and Cyber Steven, and all of these guys. Eventually there's going to be a cyber army against the Daleks. And I've got a half written already, you guys. I've got a half written already.
I love the idea that actors who have now played former companions will have to, like, put it into their will, like a do not resuscitate type of thing. Something like, you cannot bring me back when I'm dead as a Cyberman.
Robin Williams did that. You must have been reading that, right? His will says, don't use any of my stuff that I recorded for Aladdin in future Disney Aladdin movies, because he hated working with Disney so much. He wouldn't let them do it when he was alive, and he won't let them do it now that he's dead.
They really ripped him off money-wise. His pay for that part was startlingly low for an actor of his stature and a studio of that stature. But,
and he apparently did not forget it.
Yeah.
It's written into his will. God bless Cypher Robin Williams. That's all I got to say. You've rung me dry about the Zygon inversion.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, this is going to be a long mini-sode. It'll be a maxi-sode. That's kind of gross.
It's a maxi. Yeah.
Well, until next time, I'm Joshua.
God. I'm Pat.
And I'm Kelvin.
And we're saying, get off my world.